Welcome to the Versopolis podcast. I'm Mitja Drap, and today we are talking about Icelandic literature today and tomorrow. Joining me are Dr. Lara Hoffmann, a sociologist and a scholar, and Eirikur Örn Nordahl, a writer and a poet, both based in Iceland. So Lara and Eirikur, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, so great to have you on. And first of all, a very general question for both of you. What is your perception of the literature scene in Iceland today? And what are the changes that you have witnessed throughout your career as writers and scholars? Lara?
Yes, I mean, I'm originally from Germany, but I have been living in Iceland for quite some time now. And I remember when I first heard about the Icelandic literature, it was when Iceland was the guest of honor at the Frankfurt Book Fair back in 2011, which I think really put Iceland on the map of the international literary scene. So I remember actually visiting this book fair. So I was studying near Frankfurt back in the days, and I was hearing people talking, and I was thinking, what's this strange language? What are you talking? And they were saying, oh, we're speaking Icelandic. And little did I know that 13 years later, I would live in Iceland and actually speak this strange language and know.
So you were fascinated from the beginning
by
the Icelandic language. What fascinated you by the language? Is it like very similar to German, or, well, obviously not similar, but are there any parallels?
It's a Germanic language, so yeah. There are a lot of similarities. This was part of the fun of it, being able to guess some of the words already and kind of, but then again, some of the words are so different, and some of the words remind me of some words that we would use as children rather in Germany, or some dialect words. So that was kind of the fun of it, of being able to guess already some of the words. And I remember then there was, because the way Iceland was represented at this Frankfurt Book Fair was all around the Icelandic sagas and its history, and going back to the all this myth and mythological background and elves and dwarves and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I immediately connected it to those stories. I think so. This was my first impression of the Icelandic literary field, I would say.
Awesome.
Yeah, and now it has been changing a lot, and I think we will get a little bit into that as well, about how it's changing currently.
For sure. Okay, and you, Eirikur, what is your story? How did you come to know, to get in touch with Icelandic literature, or literature, like, in the...
I think there was sort of... I'm from Ísafjörður, and I grew up here, and it's very far away from everything, in a way, I think, because I mean, you read a lot of literature in school, you read poetry and read stuff, or at least you did. And but I did feel, I remember at some point discovering, like, there's a guy called Dagur Sigurðsson, who was like a beatnik, Icelandic beatnik figure. And I remember, like, we'd read a poem by him in one of those collections in the school, a very innocent one. And I remember 15, 16 or something, running into a poem of his that wasn't very innocent, it was a kind of a dirty poem, with lots of wordplay and stuff. And I remember getting the feeling that I'd been lied to, that sort of, because that the literature that had been presented to me, like, this is Icelandic literature, wasn't, in fact, they'd given me a sanitized version of, they'd given me the safe version that was all right for a child and a teenager. And what struck me also is that if people knew that this was actually literature, if my sort of fellow 15-year-olds would know that this electric thing is literature, and not just the stuff that we are being made to repeat in school, then we would be more interested. Around the same time, because I'm born in 78, so that means that around that same time, just about a couple of years later, we start getting internet access, and that kind of opens up also the literature that you can access, because all of a sudden you didn't just have, like, because when I grew up, the books you had were the books in the library, and we had a pretty nice library, but it was still a finite resource in a way. And it did not have, did not have the beatniks, which was what I became very interested in at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think I was obsessed with, for a long time, with the idea that Icelandic literature was boring and that it was insular, that it was sort of, that it did not partake in the world, that we translated way too little, and we weren't reading enough of the world, and we weren't showing enough interest in other people's literature. And I think that, I was a young man, and I was sort of, as a young man, I was rude about it. And I don't think literature was as boring as I thought it was, the literature that people were doing. I still don't. And I don't think the literature we're doing now is boring. And I think we're a lot less insular, although it is still a problem. And I guess it's a like a little brother problem, like when you feel so small that we spend so much energy and money, like as a cultural nation, in promoting ourselves, and too little in being interested in what is happening elsewhere. And
mm-hmm. A very similar. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say if that answers that all what you were asking.
Yeah, for sure it does. But okay, both of you are and were part of different writing communities, and writing communities are super important. And Lara, you are a part of the writing community Ospresan. Is this how I'm pronouncing it correctly? And
yes.
Could you tell us what is Ospresan and how did you get involved in it?
Yes, exactly. Maybe to add to what Erika said about the insularity of the Icelandic literature, because I think it's part of the charm of it in some way, because I remember this is what I think from a foreign perspective, this is also what makes draws some people to Icelandic literature, this mm-hmm. story that we tell about Icelandic literature as being unchanged and haven't changed over a long period of time. Right, but only so it mm-hmm. has a good side and a bad side, positive mm-hmm. and negative side. I think it's really mm-hmm. interesting to think about that. What insularity means for different mm-hmm. people, the positive aspects, negative aspects. And I think Ospresan is a way to maybe oppose this insularity in some way. Uh-huh. It's a writing collective and a small publisher that was founded in 2000. Well, around 2014, or it has its roots in 2014, 2015, as part of emerging from a writing course for women in Iceland, led by the writer Angela Rowlings. And this group of women then eventually started to publish a literary journal, because they found out, and it was this idea that it's really difficult for foreign voices that maybe don't fit this insular narrative to get published and take place within the Icelandic literary community and the Icelandic cultural community as a whole. And this writers collective, and I think this is something that we could be very proud of, it has been existing since 2000, since this time, so almost 10 years. I'm part of the second generation, I would say. I joined in 2016. It was basically when I had a beer with a group of friends in Reykjavik, and there was Eva Marcinek, who is a writer here in Iceland of Polish origin. I'm emphasizing the origin because a lot of the voices within Ospresan are of foreign origin. Mm-hmm. And she just invited me and told me about this group of people that are getting together and doing great stuff. And after I told her that I would be interested in books and publishing and so forth, and this is how I ended up, and I've kind of stuck around. And since then, we've been organizing workshops, publishing a literary journal, and Yeah, it is just community building, community curation has been a huge part of it, and including marginalized or people from the margins, if you want to use that word, into the Icelandic literary scene. So we talk about foreign languages, foreign background, but also, for example, Icelandic Sign Language, and it's just different languages and people that don't find their voice usually within this literary scene here.
So last podcast, we talked about an interesting subject, like literature that is written in sanatoriums and prisons, which are kind of the margins of society in some way. And I'm wondering, when you mentioned writing on the margins and authors present in Ospresan, what does literature on the margins of Icelandic society, where does it usually come from? You mentioned sign language, you mentioned immigrants, you mentioned people that don't speak the language, or?
I mean, is this already a conversation? Because those authors might not necessarily be marginalized. It's more about just differences, right? So just anything that is not fitting into this homogenous story of one language, one tradition, and so forth. I would say everything that is outside of that would be part of the margins, and I mean, Iceland, maybe it's interesting to note as well that Iceland has seen an increasing influx of migration within the last 20 years, quite a significant increase. So, of course, amongst those people that move here from abroad, there are also writers and authors that just naturally like to write and make art and be active here in Iceland as well, and finding their place.
That's awesome, because in Slovenia, it's kind of, we have a lot of literature from migrant writers coming from ex-Yugoslav republics. So these are usually people that were deemed even 30 years ago as, brothers or same of the same nationalities, or, well, Yugoslavs. And this art is still, it's very well perceived, I think, that most of the shows and music and, well, not most, but like a lot of quality art comes from that background, and people are very eager to consume such art. Well, sometimes we even say that we lack Slovenians, we lack the Balkan pathos, so we cannot write the songs which are as well written as Serbian or Croatian or Bosnian music, and so on. So it's a lot of there's a huge market for that actually here, and people love to consume this art.
That's very interesting. I think there's something, maybe this is something to look into, but why we are so fascinated by migrant literature, because we have this tradition of migrant literature in Germany, in the Nordic countries, and even people who haven't moved across countries seem to be interested in these stories. So maybe this is just something that we as humans like to talk about or hear about, moving across countries.
For sure.
I remember when I was a little girl, we read this children's story, When Hitler Stole the Pink Rabbit. I'm not sure if that's the right, correct English translation, but...
What's that? Hitler Stole the Pink Rabbit?
Hitler Stole the Pink Rabbit, and it's a story about a Jewish girl who has to escape Germany, moves to Switzerland, and finds herself moving to Paris with her family, and it's her story about adapting to a new country. And I remember this moment of her describing speaking French without realizing that she's speaking a foreign language, so suddenly realizing that she learned a new language, and that she without actively thinking about it. And I remember this really resonated with me as a child, even though I had never lived elsewhere outside of Germany. But this is just something that touched me somehow, hearing the story. And I think this is maybe one of the reasons why we like to hear stories about, migration.
It's interesting. Eirikur, do you have a take on that as well? Do you? What is your view on this literature from the margins, or rather, do you have like some experience with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have anything intelligent to say about it.
Okay.
I mean, I've lived in most of the Nordic countries, and I've lived in Germany, and I have.
Yeah. I read in your biography that you lived in like many Nordic countries throughout your career, and would you say that there are like clear and specific aspects to Nordic literature and poetry, if this is even a thing?
Well, it always depends on what you mean, and like, because both of those words, as in just if you speak about Icelandic literature or German literature, both of those or Nordic literature, those both of the concepts are like, what do you mean by literature, and what do you mean by like sort of the nationality of it, or the
fair.
And I think there's, I mean, with the Nordics, it feels like, and this is, I mean, these are very much generalizations. It feels like the Swedes, the Danish, and the Norwegians, they have their own thing that sometimes sort of melds. And you can have, I mean, the in that sense, the Swedish, Norwegian, and Danish poetry scenes, or avant-garde poetry scenes, or performance scenes, they can be, sometimes they can feel as if they're one scene and people are participating across all the borders.
Mm-hmm.
When it becomes and then there's also a level where people have become famous enough, sort of like where you, like, if you can be famous, you can be published in all of those languages, at the same time you might also be left out of Finland, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, and Greenland just groups together with Denmark in very many ways, as does the Faroe Islands to a certain extent. But but then there's a whole sort of national literature in Danish that has nothing to do with Swedish literature, or nothing to do with Norwegian literature. And the same goes like in all the different directions, which is that's probably most of the literature in terms of like just pages and words that just exists within its own context somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Within its own, within its, well, not necessarily within its own borders, but within in its own language, I think. And then there's sort of course, in that, within that same geographical area, you also have like Sami literature, and you have like different minority language literatures that have their own space, which also bleeds in between these, because Sami literature will, of course, be in all of the Sami, which even reaches up into Russia. So that would be also a Nordic, maybe that's the most Nordic literature, because it actually belongs to even geographically to the whole area.
And it's probably like, it's transnational. It goes beyond national borders, and it's been there probably, well, maybe for a long time. I have no idea about that. That's really interesting. Lara, you actually wrote an article. You're a co-author in a manuscript titled "Multilingual Writing in Iceland: The Reception of Ospersan and Its Members Nationally and Internationally." Sorry about that. And you wrote that the Icelandic media often frame Ospersan as the other by, among other things, emphasizing the members' countries of origin and lengths of stay in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
How receptive are Icelanders to immigrant voices, and how do you see steps of improving this perception? What was the main conclusion of this manuscript?
Yes, I think goes back to the question about how long are you a migrant, or how long. So, for example, if I live here in Iceland and I'm a second generation migrant, or third generation migrant, how long am I attached to this identity? Or how long are people maybe imposing this identity to me? So I think this is just something to think about, I guess, less relevant maybe for first generation migrants as I am. I think this is also this is a good question, a better question to ask to a writer of foreign origin in Iceland. But I think what's happening right now is, of course, we have seen some something, some works of migrant literature being published. But then the next step is, are those writers going beyond focusing on their migrant identity and want to explore other areas? And I think there are some indications that this is going on right now. So I think, and this article that you are referring to, the manuscript, is from 2020. So I think times have changed a little bit since then as well. So I think it's constantly evolving here. But there is a strong attachment of Icelandic national identity and the language, and as well as the names. Mm-hmm. And this is also supported by the research as well, that people with foreign names will still, some of them talk about obstacles they are facing on the labor market or when they are applying for housing and so forth, right? Because of their foreign name, that is an indicator as otherness, of being non-Icelandic. So we see this, but this is also a phenomenon that we see in other countries as well. So it's of course not just specific to Iceland as well, but I think it's quite significant here in Iceland.
So the works that you publish in Ospresan are actually translated, probably, like Polish writer. Do they publish translations of their work, or is it always translated and then published, or do you have, for example, I don't know, a small Polish community of writers writing in Polish?
No, it's not actually.
Ah, yeah, okay.
In Ospresan, yeah, it's an open invitation to everyone who is writing and in some way connected to Iceland, but even this connection is rather loosely phrased. And people are welcome to submit work in any language, in a language of their choice, and they also have the choice to decide in which whether they want to submit a translation alongside their original work or not. So some of the, if you look at the journals that have already been published, some of them texts come with a translation, others don't. And the way we select the pieces that are published in the journal is a rather democratic process where we discuss and talk about the different publications. And if there is a submission, we had in previous years, of course, cases where there was no one within the collective that could read the language. We are quite multilingual, but there are some languages that we just couldn't cover. So then we just reached out to a trustworthy person, somehow connected to our circles, who could share their thoughts about the piece. And this is the process. And it's the question is, who is this journal meant for? Because of course there are so many languages that there are very few people who will take it and be able to read everything and understand everything. But I think it shows, for once, it shows the multilingual reality of Iceland, one of people connected to Iceland. On the other hand, there might be people, for example, the biggest group of immigrants here are from Poland, but there are other big immigrants group, and there might be someone who is just browsing and sees this journal and finds a piece of poetry written by a writer based in Iceland who speaks in the same language, in your native language. So I think this moment can be quite
that must be quite a trip, meaningful. Yeah. Very meaningful.
Yeah, quite meaningful, sure. Meaningful track or a trip. So I think it's a little bit of both. It's not meant to be understood fully by just any reader. Yes, so that's the process. But there have been a few publications of there's one collection of texts by, called Polyphonia of Erlend Ypruna, which has been published by two writers here in Iceland, and they have been so edited by them, and those are translations of foreign texts, I think some of them, I'm not sure if all of them, into Icelandic. So those are foreign voices in Icelandic. I think they could describe the process a bit better than I can do here, but this is probably, so there are also a few publications of foreign writers into Icelandic, but Ósprezan is multilingual. Yeah. Oh.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. I always thought it was like, when I read it, yeah. I always thought it was like always translated. And yeah. Erikur, I want to shift gears a little bit. You are also a co-founder of Nihil, an Icelandic avant-garde small press, an association of young writers that has also been identified as one of the sources of left-wing critical thinking that underpinned Iceland's 2009 pots and pans revolution. I'm doing air quotes in the air. We remember this well from, I was like in third year of college, and it was all over the news. It was quite a spectacular thing. So how did you get involved with that? And how do you see the political role of poetry today?
I think it's, I think it was important for us that literature was political, but I don't think we saw it very much as being didactic. Or, I mean, there were certainly people it was a pretty diverse group. So there were people in it that were dedicated Marxists and sort of propagandists even to an extent. Mm-hmm. But most of the artists and the poets that were in it were people that were interested in. I mean, it's especially after such a long time, it's hard to speak for others. And if I speak for myself, it was, for me, it was strange because we had like the what do you call it? Like the general idea of there was that poetry and politics shouldn't mix, that they were antitheses and they would destroy each other somehow. And what we felt at the time, or what I felt at the time, was that it was impossible to write about life, sort of, if you are sort of, I felt I am a political person. If I write about life or anything around me, it will include politics. That did not necessarily mean that I would be telling people what to think or how to sort of, I think I was always very far away from wanting to do any kind of propaganda, but I did want to have that political dimension in there. I wanted there to be, and one of the things I was very interested in, and they did a whole series of, was just the names of dictators. I became obsessed with the ideas like that, what is it? What is, if I say just the words Pol Pot, what is that sort of, what does that conjure up in your mind? Where does that take you? And sort of, and I put those things into mostly into very silly Dadaistic poetry, but I was interested in sort of like, where does that take you? So that was, I guess that was my take on most of the, that was my biggest political stake, even though, because sort of, when you say, cause I didn't want to be, well, I do it. I keep starting my sentences over and over again.
That's fine. You didn't want to be a propagandist. Other people.
No, I do think that there is a problem with sort of political ideas mixing into artistic ideas.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
That becomes that makes it banal. I mean, it robs it of its individuality somehow, and its power for me. So I wanted to be able to write sort of political poetry without it being inflicted with my political opinions, so to speak, which was, I guess, a kind of a weird stance.
But every personal stance is already political, right? So like if you're struggling with some paradoxes or tensions that are present in your life and in society at large, and you write about it in a from a personal viewpoint, it can be very political. It can like open up very interesting questions, right?
Absolutely. But I think I was interested in what sort of, if I tell you this, sort of, if I just sort of read you this dictator poem, sort of, you tell me what it means.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like that would be my stance than sort of this is, I didn't want to be presenting, here is my meaning. I wanted to present something that I felt was jolting and that sort of moved something within the space of meaning or whatever. And then you tell me, like, and if you can sort of, you can have three people disagree about it, that would make me really happy.
Yeah. Lara, do you have a take on that as well? Should poetry and politics mix or...
I think it's interesting to disagree about things just in general as a phenomenon and just kind of having to deal with that. I think it's I think this is something to seek out and actually cherish and then see where this takes you in a respectful way. That's my thought on that.
That's very well said, because I feel more and more that we live in a world where it's very hard to respectfully disagree, I feel sometimes. Well, maybe if you like me, read the very lengthy Facebook discussions, then this is not very productive, it seems, you know. But anyway, yeah, there is something about what Eric was said that it feels kind of banal to be a propagandist or to be a propagandist, to be so, to be a demagogic kind of voice. It feels cheap in a way. So interesting.
I think the problem with with the political point is often that they need to be clear. And if you are if you are an activist, for instance, you need to have a clear idea of what you're doing, which also means that you can never undercut yourself. You always have to sort of, you have to remain, if you let down your guard somewhere on any point, you can be sure you will be hit. And as an artist, I think, or as a writer, at least for me personally, I constantly feel the need to be undercutting myself and sort of opening up sort of like that space. So in that way, it becomes antithetical to what I'm doing, is the sort of, because I'd be a horrible activist.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, me too. Because always you start to doubt yourself when you say something, and then this dialectical dialogue between you, like the thesis, antithesis, and then like it's nice to discover the paradoxes or the. It's hard to deal with that sometimes, and I feel art or poetry is perfect in displaying that, putting it out there in the world. So this is great. Okay, so we're drawing to a close. So Eirikur, you as an avant-garde poet, you're invested in the different functionalities of language. So it's not only, as you said, with the Pol Pot poem, it's not only kind of content, but also you're interested in sound, image, meaning, transgression, and the malformations of language. What are the malformations of language?
I mean, they're whatever. They are sort of any time you take the language you're given in school mostly, or by your parents, and sort of you change it, turn it on its head. And I think, like, in context also with what we've been talking about today, we should mention, like, that with the immigrant literature, what I find most interesting aesthetically is the immigrant literature that is written in Icelandic, and that is written sort of people that are writing in ways like Helen Kova, who writes in sort of her own Icelandic with a bit of Spanish, and does these strange mixes. And this is, for me, this is also sort of as a lover of the Icelandic language, this is also what sort of, this is, I feel like I've been given a treasure when you encounter these things, because you all of a sudden, the language that you think you know isn't the language that you think you know, and it becomes something else, and it becomes bigger. It grows an extra limb somewhere, which is just what language should be doing all the time.
Absolutely. Expanding all the time, growing all the time. Lara, did you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I love Helen Kova's work as well, and mixing different languages. together. And I think to give maybe a little bit of context to the listeners as well, this is in a country that prefers to invent new words for concepts. Iceland is it, instead of taking loan words, there's a whole committee dedicated to that. So it's including new languages. It's can be a little bit revolutionary, and it's not always has not always been well received in the past. And we have ongoing discussion about the influence of English in different sectors on Icelandic society. And I think this is something that Icelandic society is negotiating right now. And of course, immigrant literature is taking a part in this conversation as well. It's just a very small language community with almost no local dialects. That has suddenly confronted with increasing multilingualism. Through tourism and migration.
Just out of curiosity, how many dialects? How many dialects does Iceland have as a country?
Just one dialect.
There's just standard standard Icelandic. There used to be. I mean, people would speak much more varied types of Icelandic, and you can see it from anything like from the 18th century or whatever, and people would speak in different ways, but the nationalist movement did like what they tried to do in every country in Europe, but they failed everywhere except in Iceland. They managed to uniform the language so that we just have like this one single entity, correct Icelandic.
Yeah, because exactly. Lara, go ahead.
I mean, it's interesting that in the Faroe Islands, I think they're even fewer speakers, but they still have linguistic variation in local dialects, right? Whereas Icelandic, it's pretty much the same everywhere. So.
How many people live in the Faroe Islands, if you know?
50,000, just about.
50,000. Aha, okay, yeah. Okay. That's not so small. This is like a medium Slovenian town, or like one of the largest.
It feels like it. Sometimes you forget. But quite rich cultural landscape for being such a small. So you're always surprised. If you should come visit Iceland.
It's been on my bucket list for the longest time. I should, yeah.
Because you find cultural spaces. There are so many, for example, artist residencies all around the country. Then there are libraries. You find libraries almost everywhere in little villages. So I think, and even the small town, in Akureyri, for example, in the north, it's a town of about 20,000 inhabitants. And it feels like a major town with museums and quite an active cultural community. So I think it's a little bit, it's quite rich, the cultural scene.
Slovenia is quite, it's crisscrossed by hills and valleys. And like traditionally people didn't have much contact with people living in other valleys. So, but it also led to this surprising variety of dialect in a country of only 2 million people. Like if I go to Prekmurje and talk to an 8-year-old woman, I will not understand her. This is so crazy. There's so many influences of Hungarian and stuff like that it's impossible for me to understand. It's totally weird. So we have about like 50 dialects or something like that. And we're quite proud of that. I think it's part of our heritage. And as you said, it's always growing, and now, it's still diversifying with immigrants coming from the ex-Yugoslav countries, and this is how it should be. So, yeah. Okay.
I mean, dialects are great. We're talking about Slovenia, maybe one fun fact to mention is that we actually got connected through Anna Svetel, who is a Slovenian writer who did field work in Iceland. So she spent some time here and also published in Ospresten. And I think this also shows how transnational connections work and how... Yeah,
that's awesome. That's really great.
Well, just connected, I think. But I will let you know when we get publish a text in Slovenian and you can check it out, because I cannot read it, unfortunately.
Neither can I read Icelandic. I even struggle with your names. Eriku, did you have something to add?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you very much for this very interesting conversation. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was a pleasure. So this was the Verzópolis podcast episode 14 with Dr. Lara Hoffman and Eric Kuron Nordhall. Have a great day, everyone.